The fifth day of Sesshin, our last morning. Some just arriving. Welcome to Reverend Ellen. And some have come and gone and returned. And some have continued from the very start. This morning, celebrating, memorializing our late abbot, Karin Sobun Daiyosho, who passed from this life 1 year ago today, in the middle of this Sesshin. Were you around at that time?
Yes, I was.
In that Sesshin?
I think so.
I was on an airplane on the way back.
Mm. Yeah, it was an unusual Sesshin that we went in. Each day we would go silently process over to Catherine's house a few blocks from here and sit with her breathing body in a coma and then come back and chant and eat and process and sit over there. It was a multi-location session, and one day in the middle we got word here that she had stopped breathing, and we went over. She was dressed in her best robes with flowers all around, and we made offerings and chanted. This practice place that she gave 20 years of her life to just continues on seamlessly. I hope she would appreciate that it just keeps going. And Kobun Chino Roshi before Catherine, I hope he would appreciate too that it continues to just evolve, and people come and go, but the basic practice continues endlessly, we hope. So thinking of Catherine this morning, in this Sesshin where we've been looking at the Jijyu Zamai, the self receiving its function as taught by Nenzan Zenji, based on Dogen Zenji's teachings. This is a talk in a newsletter from 2003, where Catherine is talking about Jijyu Zamai. She says, Dogen further describes Zazen as self-fulfillment or self-enjoyment, the self receiving and accepting its function. We're talking about the big, inconceivable self. Buddha mind. The self receives its own freedom, its own contraction and relaxation, absorption and release in the fulfillment of this meditation. Practice is about penetrating the membrane of mentality that's between us and our life. Catherine says, practice is about penetrating the membrane of mentality that's between us and our life. The conceptual overlay that separates us from direct experience, that creates an us to have an experience rather than just an experience happening. The membrane of mentality that's between us and our life. That's a great phrase, I think. It's meeting, practice is meeting something beyond what the mind knows, meeting with our body, our senses, our skin, our ears. We accomplish this when we trust ourselves enough to drop off what the mind knows. I think of Hunger's knowing without touching things, not knowing things as we usually know. It is stillness which receives the benefit of this activity, as Dogen says, because it is unconstructedness in stillness. It does not appear within perception. The deep and subtle work of practice is mysterious, unrecognizable to consciousness. There's something happening here that we can recognize, and there's something happening we can't recognize through consciousness. Recently, I have come to realize that our work is to love the world just as it is. Because our discriminating mind is constantly thinking of improvements for the world, how I should be, how you should be. To love the world as it is means to completely accept those thoughts and also our regrets about how the world is. We can practice being willing to be in the world completely, wishing there weren't a war in 2003. But doing our best to respond appropriately to world circumstances and to find some way to live through the convolutions of this life. Loving the world as it is being willing to be in the only world we know. This is really the point of practice. She goes on to say, Buddhism is not some special teaching, and enlightenment is not some particular stage we attain. Our wisdom mind studies the actual life we live, our habits of mind, our desires, our disappointments, our fears, our embarrassments. Studying those phenomenal events opens the gateway to realization. We study our regrets, desires, everything that's unfulfilled. Until we understand the dynamics of our mental life fully, we will be caught by the idea that there's some better state of mind than ours. Suzuki Roshi called this hope idealistic practice. Sitting in this self-fulfilling and self-receiving samadhi, sitting quietly in unconstructed stillness, is the gift we give to the world, the gift we receive ourselves. It may not feel like unconstructed stillness. It may feel like you're complaining the entire period or being tired, being sleepy. Even that activity can be beneficial if we're willing to experience and release it without mental commentary. Which is what Nenzan's been saying too, is not adding the illusory mind's discrimination to the experience that's arising. So I think there's some tricky business around this, you know, no special teaching and ordinariness. As Patrick mentioned this morning, this was so much part of Catherine's teaching. I think it's tricky business because what we call nothing special, just being ourselves and ordinary, we could also hear as the razor's edge of the middle way. We could fall into one, off that razor's edge, fall into one extreme of a kind of apathy, a kind of like, well, since it's just, you know, I'm totally distracted and totally like, filled with greed, hate, and delusion, but I guess there's these strange teachings that's like all there is. That, I guess that was like the Buddha was just like this too, and that's all there is to it. So I might as well just continue. Let's see, what was that last angry thought I was? Let me get back to that. That would be like one extreme, which we could see that can't quite be it. And then the other extreme, we could fall off the middle way into thinking we have to get rid of this greed, hate, and delusion. We have to, there's someone other than ourself that we have to become. There's some, you know, true happy person that's different than this. If we can just get rid of this unhappy person, then they will be. That's not quite it either. So Menzan's image is the mirror, where he says the middle way of the mirror reflects good and bad thoughts without distinguishing them, and yet these thoughts are not the mirror itself. If you only see the distinction between good and bad thoughts and think it's your original mind, that's the same as if you were to grasp the reflection in the mirror and think it to be the mirror itself. This is a mistake. This analogy admonishes us not to get caught up in the distraction of thoughts, believing that our, you know, our unhappy mind state or our distracted state of mind, our greed, hate, and delusion are the mirror itself. And yet, if we think that no thought, with the elimination of all these things, is our real mind and become attached to the condition of no thought, where there's no good or bad, it's the same as thinking that where no reflection exists is the mirror itself, and thus becoming attached to the backside of the mirror. If the mirror reflects nothing, it's the same as if it were a piece of stone or tile. The function of light of the mirror is lost. This analogy admonishes us not to get caught up in the dullness or neutrality of no thought. To maybe a similar kind of middle way. It's like we're not eliminating our ordinary thoughts, distractions, laziness, obsessions, all of that stuff. If we were to eliminate it and in order to find the stillness of nothing happening, that would be like getting attached to the backside of the mirror. And then it's just, that's not so interesting. It's not so alive. It's just like a tile or rock, the dull, back painted side of the mirror. And yet to grasp all that habitual activity of mind as our true self and get caught up in it, as he says, then that just continues the cycle of suffering. So this, between the front the reflections in the front being the real reality, and the nothingness on the back being the real reality. Right between those is the surface of the mirror that's just unchanging clarity that doesn't block any discriminating images, doesn't try to get rid of anything or grasp anything. And strictly speaking, we could call that mirror awareness ordinary mind. And it's always with us.
It makes me think, Catherine translated the Dogen Fascicle of Miracles with Cobbs. And, that one, Dogen equates kind of our ordinary life and calls them miracles.
Mm.
And what a way to sort of go through your life saying to yourself, this is a miracle, this is a miracle. My breakfast is a miracle, my work is a miracle. And that, kind of does what you're talking about. I mean, when you're thinking of your ordinary life as a miracle, you can't fall on the side of, I'm just going to, keep going with my angry mind or keep planning my car repair day. You don't fall on that side, and yet it also seems to take care of the other side, too, of wanting, kind of no thought or...
No breakfast. That's not so much fun.
Because you're kind of in another state when you're practicing that kind of miracle practice.
Yeah, appreciating whatever is arising as a miracle. And sometimes in Sesshin it starts to seem that way, that what we think of as ordinary starts to seem kind of miraculous and amazing. Just to be sitting, just to be chanting. That was a beautiful ceremony this morning. Have some of Catherine's old students who hardly ever come around kind of miraculously appear and come. Yes, and our little Sesshin became very large for 20 minutes. Well, actually, the whole period of Zazen, people came out. Yeah, quite ordinary, of course, and quite miraculous and inconceivable. What are we celebrating anyway? What are we acknowledging in such an event? The miraculousness of ordinary mind, the extraordinary quality of ordinariness. A little bit more from Menzan's self-receiving its function awareness essay before we leave this. He goes on to talk about thinking of this reflective mirror that's not blocking anything out. It's everything that appears on it is extremely ordinary, and yet ordinary in the sense of like everyday. Even it looks like it's like habitual tendencies are all our this one again. I'm still like this. All of that stuff is just right there on the surface of the mirror. Not not the slightest bit separate from the mirror. And yet, we don't call that stuff the mirror itself. Not separate from the mirror, and yet not one with the mirror. Not one, not two, with the mirror. The three poisonous minds, greed, hate, and illusion, arise within the functions of one mind. This one mind creates three good realms if it's pulled by goodness, and it creates the three lower realms if it's pulled by harmfulness. So there's the mirror, and it can become anything. It can reflect anything. So depending on our intentions, the mirror can reflect heaven or hell. Greed creates the realm of desire. Anger creates the realm of form. Ignorance creates the formless realm. This is the way that the world as circumstances and the world of sentient beings as the six realms are fabricated. Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas, remember they're the ones that are, they just want to leave. They want to eliminate all suffering as quickly as possible because they're extremely afraid of suffering. Whereas bodhisattvas courageously enter the world of challenge and difficulty. So Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas are frightened by this cycling through suffering, and they try to eliminate greed, hate, and delusion, which are the basic causes of this transmigration, in order to not be reborn in the realms of samsara. They call this leaving, departing, cutting off birth and death, samsara. But this is not the same as being free from birth and death, as is the liberation of the Tathagata. See the difference? Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas try to, like, leave birth and death. Eliminate it. And the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas are free from life and death, right in the middle of life and death, like a mirror is free from all those nasty mind states, right in the middle of reflecting them. The way of great bodhisattvas is like this. The basis of transmigration and suffering is nothing other than our own mind. Furthermore, when we clearly illuminate our mind and realize that this mind is nothing but a phantom, and that we cannot grasp the mind by thoughts of discrimination using concepts such as existence or non-existence, we no longer try to either annihilate mind nor indulge in it. Instead, we simply illuminate it without adding discriminating thoughts. When we just illuminate our mind without adding thoughts and discrimination, the three poisonous minds of greed, hate, and delusion also have the nature of being dropped off. One of Dogen's favorite terms. They drop off. That is, they're beyond discrimination and ungraspable. Therefore, these three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion are not a bit different from the eternal Dharma body of the Tathagata. It's a big statement. Well, we just illuminate greed, hate, and delusion, or reflect it like a mirror, reflect these greed, hate, and delusion, and every thought and all the bodily sensations that go with it, all the turmoil, all the fantasies, all the regrets, all the turbulence, all the joy, all the relaxation, all the thoughts that this is it, finally, all of that stuff is just illumined or reflected in the mirror without adding anything to it, adding any reality to it or non-reality to it. Greed, hate, and delusion are dropped off and ungraspable. They're reflections in the mirror. Therefore, they're not a bit different from the eternal Dharmakaya of the Buddha. When we thoroughly realize that the three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion are nothing but the eternal Dharma body of the Tathagata, it becomes obvious that all sentient beings transmigrating in the six realms also have the nature of this eternal Dharma body and lack nothing. In other words, if we can see this principle, that our own neurotic mind states are actually just shining reflections on the surface of mirror awareness, we see it's the same for everybody. Lacking nothing. Since we understand this reality, we give rise to bodhicitta and vow to lead all sentient beings to the eternal Dharma body of the Tathagata. This is carrying out the practice and realization of a bodhisattva. I don't know exactly the logic there. He says, like, when we see this for ourselves, that our neurotic habitual mind is merely reflections, you know, maybe very, very real. They're really affecting us. They can make us sick. They can kill us, right? But they're still, they're dropped off. They slide off them. They don't stick to the mirror. And then we see, oh, this is the same for everybody. That's when bodhicitta arises, this bodhisattva vow. So he doesn't really explain how that bodhicitta arises at that point, but maybe it's because we see that all suffering beings everywhere have this potential. That all these suffering beings that are totally caught up in greed, hate, and delusion are also not really caught up in greed, hate, and delusion, or they have the complete potential to be free. Their greed, hate, and delusion is dropping off moment to moment also. So it's not like these people are hopeless. they're too sunk in greed, hate, and delusion. How could they ever eliminate them? We say, oh, actually, it's not about eliminating them. It's about understanding them differently. Settling into greed, hate, and delusion so thoroughly that they drop off. So we see, maybe it's when we see that potential in everyone, then we have an even stronger motivation to, let's practice with everyone. let's somehow be with sentient beings in a way that helps them warm up to this reality, which could be like, come sit zazen with me. But that's maybe kind of narrow. It might just be like the way that we are can just be a little bit more at ease with our own greed, hate, and delusion and be with other people like that. Maybe that's the way of, one way of saving, or at least, or, you know, conveying some way, like, sort of like, I wish I could get rid of this. And then they think, yeah, you must wish you could, because that's pretty like lousy what you're doing there. But instead, like, oh, I'm just this way, okay? I'm just this person. Sorry, but again, not really sorry. I'm just this person, and it's okay, and I don't want to harm you, and if I have, I deeply apologize, and I'm probably going to again, and I'll apologize again, and let's just love each other in this messed up realm. that kind of attitude maybe actually helps other people, like, oh, really? we can love each other in this messed up realm? I thought we have to get rid of it. It's dropping off. So then, it's just interesting here, I think, because we have some, you know, we have a precept ceremony coming up. I've heard. In next month. So he gets into this discussion now about these three pure precepts of bodhisattvas. When we, the threefold pure precepts observed by bodhisattvas are embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, embracing and sustaining good qualities, and embracing and sustaining living beings. Vowing to do all good deeds without exception is called embracing and sustaining good qualities. The greedy mind of ordinary people is transformed and functions differently in this practice. So greed, these three pure precepts are connected with dropping off greed, hate, and delusion. So the greed is practiced with by embracing and sustaining all good qualities, vowing to do all beneficial actions, vowing to refrain from harming others is called embracing and sustaining standards of conduct. The angry or hateful mind is transformed and works differently through this practice. Because this is particularly about, like, the rest of the standards of conduct are like refraining from harming, the precepts of restraint of from harming others, not killing beings, not taking what's not given, etc. is one way to look at those are the standards of conduct.
How would you interlace that with your earlier reading where you said that greed, hate, and delusion are the Buddha body is greed, hate,
yeah, and yeah, interesting, huh? They're like, why would you bother with such precepts, right? But so it's right after that that he starts talking about this, because he, and maybe it's because when we see that greed, hate, and delusion are the Buddha body, then he says, then we see that's the same for everyone, that everybody's greed, hate, and delusion is their Buddha body. And then from that realization arouses this bodhisattva vow to help others, maybe you could say help others to also realize that and to be at ease, see that their greed, hate, and delusion are reflections on the mirror. And the way we help them to do that as bodhisattvas is we take up these bodhisattva vows. That's how I hear it, since it just follows right after that. He's talking about then we want to live the bodhisattva way, and then these are our bodhisattva practices. So it's a great question.
Somehow I'm trying to see how the dualism balances with the non-dualism.
Yeah, that's going on here. Yeah, dualism balance with non-dualism.
Being part of it.
Yeah, so you could say you could maybe hear these bodhisattva precepts as like a skillful means to the way that to demonstrate to others this freedom in the midst of greed, hate, and delusion is to embrace and sustain all good qualities and standards of conduct and all beings. But I think it's true that you can hear them as like, now we're back into thinking that the realness is an antidote to them. So, he says, the hate mind of ordinary people is transformed and works differently in this practice of embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, of refraining from harming others. It's not so much that it's trying to repress the angry, hateful mind. It's more that it just works differently through this practice. He doesn't explain so far here, but you could say just with that intention to, for the benefit of others, to demonstrate to others that it's okay to be a human being, then we actually take up these practices. And it's okay to fail also, I think would be part of it too. It's just like, here's the direction.
I kind of see it as the letting go of it. Like when I get really angry at something, the ability to be angry and then move on.
Yeah.
Be happy and then move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the ability to move on is,
yeah,
is accepting.
Mm-hmm.
Not seeing yourself as anger or,
yeah,
an angry person.
It's just right.
Something that arises and then you move on.
Yeah, so as you say, not seeing that you're an angry person, that's a little extra. It's more like that's not truly who you are, because you could say in a way who you truly are is the mirror that just reflects the anger. And so that might be the way we think of it, or it might just be like, I know that it's not, it's just what's happening right now. It's not, there's no essence of it or essence of me being that way. Therefore, there's some ease or lightness with it. And it's changing and the reflections keep changing. So yeah, being willing to keep going. Whereas if we really reify the anger, it's not just a reflection here. This is like my identity is I am like this angry person. Then we're really like, we're solidifying it, and it's hard to move on. And I think we probably all have that experience sometimes, like that we like add on. You know, we're angry, but then we get angry about being angry, and like this again, and like, and why am I always this way? And we're just, it's just continuing to perpetuate it. Where it's like, okay, here it is again, arising to according to conditions. Okay, let's find some spaciousness. That's already here around it. Let's look for that spaciousness or mirror-like quality that's reflecting it. And then it maybe doesn't immediately disappear, but it's more workable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we can move on. The mirror can move on to the next reflection.
Right.
Or more like the mirror never moves. But the scene of reflections can move on to the next scene.
I was quoting Trungpa Rinpoche, talking about the spaces between things. And having that help you to see that anything that comes up is going to change.
Yeah.
And that it's those spaces that...
Gaps.
And
cool spaces between fiery thoughts or just, reflective mirror-like spaces between what seem like solid objects. Yeah, the spaces between the spacious spaces between the constricted claustrophobic little habitual neurosis, something like that. Yes.
What's helpful for me is the sense that if I'm aware of conflict or anger toward me, that I can see that that's not who that person is, as I think what I'm hearing. that it's just the anger, that what's the place, that between place is to hear the anger, because sometimes that's just what needs to be expressed, and to let that be felt, I mean, to feel, to hear it, but to allow in that space something else to arise. Because that something else is also there.
Yeah.
And I really
there's potential for everything.
For everything that maybe it's not even opposite, because that's a duality kind of thing. It's they're both there, because the love is there as well. It's hidden in the anger. The forgiveness is there as well. Even for myself, you know, and so I think that really between thing is so critical in allowing that other to come up, to also rise.
Yeah.
So I can be very quick at just being in the conflict, and what is that stepping back and just observing and not being victims of conflict and anger, but just allowing, you know, in a safe kind of environment for something else to arise.
Yeah. And maybe we could say that, is it really that the exact antidote to everything is right there, or is it more that, thinking of the mirror metaphor, it's like there's the anger, is the reflection on the surface, but the mirror is naturally forgiving. So it's like in the space between moments of anger, we see the mirror that has all these qualities like forgiveness. I mean, we could say in a way forgiveness is another reflection on the mirror that would arise at another time. We could say that too. But what allows for the forgiveness when there's some space there is maybe more that naturally this basis of mind is naturally forgiving, because it's not justifying the anger anymore. So then it's naturally forgiving. Whereas if we think the anger is more than just a reflection, then we'll justify it and back it up and defend it, and I have the right to be angry. So just the last part of this three pure precepts thing is vowing to release innumerable beings from suffering by transferring or dedicating the merit from the practice of refraining from all harm and doing all good to innumerable sentient beings without exception is called embracing and sustaining all beings. That's maybe a kind of surprise. Right? The first two sounded pretty straightforward, right? Refraining from harming, which transforms transforms anger or hatred into forgiveness, is the embracing and sustaining the standards of conduct, doing all kinds of good activities to help beings, transforms greed through the practice of embracing and sustaining good qualities. And then what's the practice of embracing and sustaining all beings? It's dedicating the merit from the other two pure precepts to all beings without exception. That was a surprising one, I thought. Which is just this Mahayana principle of transferring or dedicating merit is so important. And maybe a way to, you could understand it in a kind of mystical way, or a straightforward way, is it's just the results of our positive action. So those first two precepts are like positive activity, and they create good results for us and the world, and we just offer that goodness that's created by not harming others and doing good for others. We like spread that, the results of that goodness to all beings. That'd be maybe a more tangible way of talking about transferring the merit from those practices. And this is where the delusion, ignorance or delusion mind is transformed and acts differently in this practice. So it's one of these Dharma things where the, you know, matching up every possible list of three things. You know, greed, hate, and delusion are addressed by these three pure precepts. And then as bodhisattvas, we continue this practice realization of these three pure precepts until we complete ultimate awareness. And when, having realized complete Buddhahood, these three are called the three virtues of the Tathagata. That is the virtue of complete wisdom that drops off all ignorance and actualizes ultimate awareness. The virtue of exhausting or cutting through all delusions, which actualizes ultimate nirvana, and the virtue of complete compassion, which releases all sentient beings. These three are also referred to as the three Buddha bodies. The embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, interestingly, creates the Dharmakaya, the formless Dharmakaya. The embracing and sustaining good qualities creates the bliss body, the Sambhogakaya, and embracing and sustaining all beings creates the Nirmanakaya, the transformation body, the manifestation body, which makes the most sense because it's with an actual human body that that's how you can actually help beings. Therefore, this one mind creates all the different realms depending on the way it's used. Astringent persimmons become very sweet after having been dried. If we try to squeeze out the astringency, the persimmons will never become sweet. This is, the footnote says there's these two kinds of persimmons in Japan. Ellen maybe knows about this. That like one kind ripens on the tree and gets sweet on the tree, and the other kind, it will never get sweet on the tree. But wait, it always is astringent. But if you take it and dry it, it then gets super sweet. You know, the astringent kind?
Yeah, and I only discovered about maybe 3 or 4 years ago that works.
Dry it.
You can only do it. This is interesting. Do you want to hear this?
Sure.
If you wait for them to get sweet, they're a complete mush and they'll fall. You know, you can heart and all the animals will go after them, which is fine, but you'll never get them. And so you pick them when they're bright orange and beautiful, but they're still hard. You cannot eat them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I slice them very, very thin and just put them on these cookie sheets in a low, like a oven, like 100 degrees for like 12 hours. All the astringency goes away, and they're like little stained glass, beautiful, dry, still sweet.
Mm-hmm.
You can't eat them when they're hard.
And astringency is such an interesting flavor, huh?
Yeah, it's so reject.
Oh, total reject, yeah. That kind of like almost dry.
Can't do it.
It's like sulfur, I don't know what. But it's intense to bite those non-ripe persimmons. Yeah, I just got to spit it out.
I wanted to ask you if you've ever tried making cinnamon bread. Oh, yes. that's, I have that in my freezer, but I call it, I call it persimmon mush. Persimmon pudding.
Pudding, yeah.
It's perfect, yeah. Perfect, yeah.
But I have, I think I discovered that you can't boil it. I never tried boiling. Something weird happens.
Yeah, no, I just smush it. And,
yeah, if you just pudding like just as it is cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a persimmon, a weird fruit that way. So if we try to squeeze, it's a
miracle.
There's a persimmon tree right next door, isn't there?
You know,
talk about a miracle.
It's like there's a million persimmons that we can see every year, but there only ends up being one or two that ever gets harvested. We'll have to pay attention to it.
Where they go.
If you just see them disappear, the birds get along.
Or net. So these astringent ones, they only become sweet after having been dried. If we try to squeeze out the astringency, the persimmons will never become sweet. Thus, the astringency of these three poisonous minds of greed, hate, and delusion becomes the sweetness of the three virtues. The Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas cannot produce the sweetness of the three virtues because they try to squeeze out the astringency of the three poisons. So bodhisattvas just let these ripen, naturally ripen. They don't try to get rid of the astringency, they just let them sit there on low heat. Turn up the heat just a little bit and place them on a rack like this.
Actually, in Japan, they hang it out in the cold.
Right?
To
dry.
Yeah.
No, the whole thing.
Thread
it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's what's being sweetened, and to not, to deny them, to try to get rid of them, or even to deny them is a little bit like trying to become the backside of the mirror. either just block them off, and then become, we can maybe deny them by being really dull. He called the backside of the mirror kind of like dullness, like, I mean, if we go to sleep, we can deny them, like, or just totally distract ourselves. I'm not, no greed, hate, and delusion around here. I'm just, you know, off somewhere else. And then we're like, then our reflective capacity, our aliveness is lost. So reflecting them or in the a mirror and the persimmon are quite different metaphors. We're not going to try to combine them. Although mirrors do reflect persimmons. Mirrors don't ripen like that. Yeah, not trying to remove anything, but naturally, with it, mysteriously and miraculously, the astringent persimmons become sweet by not avoiding the astringency, sitting long with greed, hate, and delusion. We see, we recognize, and then something about like relaxing with them. Even if the mirror thing seems obscure, the mirror, it, you know, when we're like, here it is again, just, okay, I accept, I breathe with this, relax into it. I would venture to even say that ability to just relax and be with them may come from the mirror. Buddha nature that knows this is what we have to do, is just relaxing, is kind of being like a mirror. Maybe it can't quite recognize the mirror, and the mirror thing seems too obscure and subtle. But if we're just relaxing, that is actually being more and more like a mirror. A mirror is basically like relaxation with wild and crazy images is a quality of the mirror.
I'm also thinking of it as reflecting, but also befriending.
Yeah.
Being a friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To the degree of hate.
Yeah.
Because part of their function, I feel, is to catch us.
Mm-hmm.
Way,
yep.
And then something happens, and it's like, April Fools.
It's funny, yeah. The way they try to catch us is to say, like, I'm really annoying, aren't I? Like, I'm what you're trying to get rid of here, but look, you can't get rid of me. Here I am. I snuck up when you were least expecting, and I'm certainly not your friend, am I? That's when we have to, that would be like, they can catch us. And then we have to say, no, actually, you are my friend. What are you talking about? You are. Please come in. You're welcome to be here. What do you mean? Yes, now you can sit here with me. Greed, hate, and delusion, too. And, yeah, exactly. A mirror is befriending the reflections. The drying persimmon is befriending astringentness.
Well, I was just going to say that persimmon image kind of addresses Gabriel's question about the astringency really is a part of the perfect persimmon.
Mm.
And it's not such a negative thing.
It's what will actually become the sweetness. It has that its essence is sweet. Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing to eliminate except for Sravakas and Prajika Buddhists. And they're also okay.
Well, he said the first day, Sravakas have the ability to develop.
Yeah, that's actually from the sutra. Says Sravakas, which evolve through opening to compassion, are a kind of bodhisattva. Yeah.
Well, maybe. Is with the astringencies, that sometimes severe astringency like that can be medicinal. For certain situations.
Some medicines are naturally astringent.
Yeah. I think of like Chinese medicine.
Yeah.
In particular.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's exactly the antidote.
Yeah, the Chinese and different kinds of herbal medicine in general often taste horrible. Often bitter is really a common quality. Huh? The body naturally, it's really hard to get it down sometimes. But that's what we need for healing, to just receive the bitterness or astringency, healing by... looking through Catherine's talks, she really seemed to be a big theme for her is like just really becoming intimate with all our like karmic stuff, afflictive mind states and all of that. Really just getting to know it. Even if we don't get into seeing how it's a reflection on the mirror, maybe naturally, the more we get to know it, we naturally see how that's so. But we can't skip the step of like just, becoming intimate with ourselves, really getting to know these tendencies of ourselves over and over, maybe kind of bitter medicine. But seems so necessary. Seems like there's no bypassing that. That's why Sesshin is quite humbling. We get to see it all, go through it all. Anything else? And Nanzan says, to close, since this samadhi cannot be grasped by discriminatory thoughts, no commentators on the sutras and commentaries who only try to interpret the meaning of the words can fathom it even in a dream, no matter how intelligent they are. So after all of this talk and blabber, it's all just pointing towards the inconceivable. Only when we sit zazen in our daily life are our eyes open to the reality outside the domain of thoughts and discrimination. We just illuminate our thoughts, which moment to moment come up and go away, refrain from fabricating, grasping or rejecting, hate and attachment. As with the Tathagata, what we do in our zazen is expressed as radiating the great light, illuminating the whole world of the 10 directions, and releasing all living beings from suffering. Sounds miraculous. Even if all Buddhas in the 10 directions, as innumerable as the sand grains in the San Lorenzo River, try to measure the merit of one person's zazen, they could never comprehend such a thing. We dedicate any positive energy arisen from our efforts in this sesshin to the complete freedom of all beings right in the midst of their greed, hate, and delusion. May they ripen into sweetness like a persimmon. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.